ever seen. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really pleased to be sitting opposite Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, author of After the Cold War, and a columnist whose work appears in newspapers and journals across the country, and someone who has been a frequent morning show guest for more than 20 years. And we are always appreciative of each and every opportunity we have to welcome Professor Sear onto the program, and as of late, to welcome him back into our studios, now that such things are possible, in-person interviews, that is. And we will be covering a plethora of different issues and topics over the next few minutes. Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the program.
Well, thank you. It's always nice to be invited back, especially here, my friend. It's a real pleasure and always educational, let me stress.
Well, you're the one who has so much to offer, and always appreciate as well the deep historical context with which you talk about current events and issues. You shared with me last night, and I was so glad you did, your most recent column, which I don't think has yet been published. I think you mentioned that it will be published in the Kenosha News later this week, maybe Friday.
Yeah, and other places before then, but it's basically the weekly column that around here appears at the end of the week.
And it was a column in which you offer some thoughts into the quite dramatic recent testimony on Capitol Hill by Chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, General Mark Milley, and a couple of his counterparts, talking primarily about the United States' very difficult, chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan and its aftermath. But also,
that's putting it politely, as usual.
As well as talking about some other matters related to the nation of China and so on. One of the things that you talk about in your column is that you have some concerns about some of the statements that General Milley has made, and you contrast him with certain figures from our country's past generals who conducted themselves in very different fashion. Tell our listeners a little bit about this contrast that you think it is important for us to understand.
Yeah, the main concern was that he was speaking publicly at all, including to the ubiquitous and apparently immortal, at least eternal, Bob Woodward of Watergate scandal and revelations fame. He and his partner at the time, Carl Bernstein of the Washington Post, dug out information that was instrumental in detonating the Watergate controversy, which is shorthand for a series of problems, and including violations of the law by people in Nixon's administration that ultimately brought down the president. History is always important, and this is particularly important. I don't think someone in General Milley's position should be talking to the media at all. Peggy Noonan, a very good columnist in the Washington Post, has a column within the last few days that reveals that in a forthcoming book co-authored by Woodward, but also by other columnists from, I think, the New York Times and I think the Washington Post, he's being quoted quite widely. There is a statement traditional in the press, as you know, sir, as a good journalist, no comment. And that used to be used quite frequently in Washington by people with real authority. And I strongly believe it would be good for it to come back into vogue.
Right. And and particularly our highest ranking generals should be utilizing that kind of restraint. And I think what you're saying is that restraint seems to be largely a thing of the past.
General Marshall was chief of staff of the Army during World War II and also the crucial lead up to the war. He's just a remarkable public servant, generally rightly regarded as crucial to getting us through the war. President Roosevelt early on made him his military right hand, although he was not formally the chief military aide to the president. The crucial story, which is worth repeating in some detail for our listeners, FDR in 1938 proposed to his cabinet and senior officials, especially the military brass, that we send 10,000 airplanes to our military, he said, so that we would be prepared in case we went to war with Europe. As usual, with President Roosevelt, there was at least one ulterior motive. The record is clear now. One of his schemes to try to head off Nazi domination of Europe was to send the planes to Britain and France. Roosevelt, who had this condescending patrician air privately that some people, including Marshall, found irritating as hell. Roosevelt described his plan. He also saw himself as a grand military strategist, which he was not. He'd been Assistant Secretary of the Navy in the First World War, but was not Winston Churchill in terms of direct experience and strategic vision. He did have great political skill, obviously, and a tremendous strategic vision politically for the world, in my opinion. Anyway, he went around the room and said, I think you gentlemen will all agree that this is a worthy plan. You agree with me, don't you, George? And Marshall said, no, Mr. President, I do not. And then off the top of his head, without preparation, as usual, FDR took these people by surprise. He went through, impromptu, he went through a long list of omissions, including where we would find 10,000 pilots for these planes. Sensing that FDR had something else in mind. Roosevelt, who was compelled to be the center of attention and would ham it up even at senior meetings, looked straight ahead with a poker face throughout this, and then at the end simply said, apparently, thank you very much, gentlemen, and wheeled himself out of the room in his wheelchair, after which the military brass, the generals, the admirals, cabinet officers lined up and shook hands with Marshall, bidding him farewell. The Secretary of the Treasury, who was a good friend of his, said, it's been nice knowing you, George. Yeah. And they filed out. When Marshall got back to his office, he found that the president's secretary had called his office immediately after he got back to the Oval Office and said he wanted to see General Marshall at his earliest convenience. From that time forward, Roosevelt consulted Marshall very, very carefully. Never again called him by his first names. There were things about Marshall that antagonized the president. He absolutely refused to socialize with their wives. He would never go to the private quarters in the White House because he knew how seductive the president could be, but also that was General Marshall. And FDR will continue to call him George behind his back, said, among other things, to his very few confidants, you know. With George, I'm quite confident. He's probably the only person in Washington. I'm quite confident as soon as we're done, after I've overruled him, as I do on occasion, he will not be immediately going to the Congress to put political knives in my back. So kind of a long lecture on General Marshall, but it's worth it, especially today in Washington and given the nature of our contemporary political and media cultures.
Right. So
no offense.
General Marshall's high level of integrity and is also his sense of restraint were just two of many of his laudable qualities that made him so indispensable at that crucial point in our history.
A very crucial point. He was instrumental in getting us ready for the war. He was also trusted. And that, you know, his character percolated throughout the country. People had faith in President Roosevelt as an effective leader who cared about them, as he did at some level, and Mrs. Roosevelt especially, who was a particularly vital figure in terms of the public. My first job when I was extremely young, not thanks to me, but thanks to my dad's work ethic, was with a small businessman in Los Angeles who, as a young farm boy in Nebraska, I think, after Pearl Harbor, immediately enlisted in the Army. He'd been on Bougainville in the South Pacific fairly early in the war. Bougainville was so horrific, we never took it in New Guinea near Guadalcanal. Hmm. We simply sealed the Japanese up on a peninsula and moved on. He was very badly wounded and was clearly disfigured from an artillery barrage. He had a compulsion to talk to me about his war experiences, which was quite gripping and quite disturbing, and convinced me early on that you should keep your war stories to yourself, especially around younger people. But General Marshall died, coincidentally. He and I would work together on weekends, for which I got paid, renovating his office. He didn't have kids of his own. And the kind of reverence with which he talked is, frankly, rather disturbed and restless man who eventually lost the business that he'd started. The reverence with which he reflected on Marshall, I found quite instructive and very reflective of that generation, which, in a very real sense, sir, made it possible for you and I, to others, to sit around here comfortably today to talk freely as we wish.
Let's talk a little bit more about General Miley's testimony before Congress about the United States and their withdrawal from Afghanistan and so on. And one of the things that that he said, and I'm not you're obviously not a spokesman for General Milley, but I'm curious if you can see, but I'm curious if you understand his one of his statements better than I do. He was talking about how our withdrawal from Afghanistan was really two withdrawals, a withdrawal of U.S. troops, but also evacuation of non-combatants. I mean, that both of those operations needed to happen, which is part of what made it really difficult. And he said, in describing that, it was a logistical success, but a strategic failure. And I think those are two different terms. And I'm just left not really understanding what he's saying there about it being a logistical success but a strategic failure.
I wouldn't presume to speak for him, of course, right. And I just ought to emphasize that given current controversy. I don't have any off-the-record personal insight either. Military men and women with whom I do have experience from my youth and thereafter, but one thing that impressed me very directly when I was in the Army is often the best sorts of officers and NCOs, but those in senior positions will tend to focus very heavily on logistics, and success is crucial. An old cliche is that armchair generals, including in the media and certainly in academia, focus on battles and heroics, and if they're pro-military, as they tend to be. But real generals and admirals focus on logistics, supply, the often mind-numbing and essential practical aspects to any kind of military operation. Marshall was a genius at that. His protege Eisenhower was a genius at that, especially in modern warfare. It's essential. I don't know, but I think he may have been alluding to that.
Right.
And trying to be complimentary to his commander-in-chief.
Right.
I don't think he's being obviously disloyal, in great contrast to someone like MacArthur, for instance,
right,
in that earlier time.
Right. It did come up, of course, in these dramatic hearings that that he, among others, advised President Biden that they didn't think a complete withdrawal of American troops was necessarily advisable, that, that some presence should remain, but that ultimately President Biden opted for complete withdrawal, which of course was his prerogative as commander-in-chief. And maybe he's alluding to the strategy of a complete withdrawal was a mistake, but at least within that flawed strategy, maybe logistically they were able to accomplish some heroic things in terms of effecting some kind of evacuation. I mean, obviously not complete and pretty messy and in some ways destructive.
President Biden overruled his senior military commanders, who urged, as they have over the years, to leave a residual force of about 2,500, which we've had for some time. We took no casualties, as far as I know, within the year before the withdrawal. I think it's, with no disrespect to the office of the presidency, I think it's utterly disgraceful that Biden decided to do this. I think it's very healthy. It's in the public record. It explains why he is now fully underwater in terms of public opinion polls. I think it was an absolutely disgraceful decision, an absolutely disgraceful act. He badmouthed our allies in Afghanistan during the longer term and slower motion disaster in South Vietnam. Senior American officials never badmouthed our South Vietnamese allies. Many of those units fought quite well, as was true in Afghanistan for at least some of them. I think it's absolutely disgraceful personal behavior, and I don't mind saying so on the air. You don't leave your people behind. The first and foremost lesson in the military is you don't leave your people behind. And we did that. There are people at risk. Ryan Casey, an outstanding recent graduate now serving in the U.S. Marine Corps. He was a finance major, and Cassie Lau, one of our recently departed colleagues, was his principal advisor, but he sought me out, and I was his advisor. I got in touch with him recently because a young, still Afghan woman who was an advisee of mine in political economy, now making her way in banking in Milwaukee, called me out of the blue as things were collapsing, and we were holding out at the one airport because she has relatives in Afghanistan, and she was afraid they would be raped and murdered. I stay in touch. That hasn't happened yet, but they're living in isolation and in terror. It's absolutely disgraceful. Ryan, as his, in true to his character, he went out of his way quite desperately. Unfortunately, she only got in touch with me a few hours before the deadline. Some hours before the deadline, but he did his best, including contacting buddies personally who were at the airport. But leaving your people behind and behaving this way is utterly disgraceful. And I won't say more than that on the air, but I can assure you I'm being restrained. That's my opinion, but it's haunting us. And
right.
We didn't handle Vietnam that way. For the military to withdraw first, leaving our close collaborators and allies behind, along with others, it's the reverse of the way you do it, as common sense would indicate. Your military should be the last to leave.
Right. The non-combatants evacuated first to
right.
whatever extent you can, and then the military leaves.
Logistically, we did get a lot out despite the very, very rigid timeline imposed by the president. So I believe the general was alluding to that. So,
right.
Sorry, but you ask me, I tell you, and this is particularly important. And it's certainly the news we know reliably absolves our military of this disgraceful behavior.
Another dramatic topic, although probably of less central importance, revolves around General Milley and phone calls he made to military leaders in China in the waning days of the Trump presidency. And this is kind of it's an intriguing story, and of course the testimony kind of brought that kind of back to the fore a little bit, in which General Milley made these phone calls to military leaders in China, reassuring them that President Trump was not going to be launching some kind of attack against China in the last weeks of his presidency, which some called a treasonous act. That is General Milley making these phone calls and so on. What did you make of that? Is that a story of any significance at all?
I make of that, sir, that's a good example of a situation where someone should say no comment. Mm. I did talk to counterparts in China or Russia. Actually, I think it makes sense, quite apart from the personalities and the politicization and the fact, not my opinion, an undeniable fact that a large percentage of our dominant media just cannot stand Donald Trump. And make that clear, despite their professional obligations. I don't blame him personally. I actually can't stand him either in personal terms. I didn't even think he could get elected president. But that's the undercurrent. A good opportunity for a no comment. Actually, it's reassuring that we're in good professional contact. We actually conduct military exercises with the military of China. Their people regularly visit our forces, and I believe something of a counterpart happens as well, but they spend time in the U.S. We have collaborative exercises with the Russians, at least their Navy, not in the Baltic where things are tense, but in South Asia where we have ongoing commitments related to Afghanistan. I think this is all very positive compared to the Cold War. And outside of no comment, Milley might have finessed something like this.
Right. Let's turn our attention to a very different story, but first let me reintroduce you. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with Dr. Art Seer Clausen, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, and a very frequent visitor to the morning show. Yeah.
Can I make one other point about General Milley? His background is in special forces and special operations. Quite a remarkable career, not surprisingly. He's also a Princeton graduate, as I say, who went through the ROTC program to get his commission. I say that not for any elitist reason, but our military is increasingly separate, segregated socially from the rest of American society. And that was the case during the Vietnam War to a degree. A grand total of one Harvard graduate was killed in Vietnam, for example. Not 1%, but one man was killed in Vietnam. Any death is a tragedy. But elite institutions and people with considerable wealth and connections in civilian life tend not to serve in our current military. And it predates the end of the draft, but has been reinforced by it. Milley brings connections to the wider society that are impressive. But also, special operations types tend to be very idiosyncratic. If they're going to succeed, they tend to be non-mainstream. They were a great contrast during the Vietnam War with the sort of corporate-style Army officers that Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, he wanted to make the Army like a corporation. Since then, the idea has fortunately been abandoned. General Westmoreland, the field commander in Vietnam, who was kicked upstairs to be Army Chief of Staff after the Tet Offensive, he liked the idea of business. He'd gone to Harvard Business School. And I've always felt one reason that Westmoreland got along well with McNamara, the rest of the brass couldn't stand the secretary, was that he had this corporate vision. General McChrystal is another special operations officer who got top command and then got in trouble and was fired by President Obama, quite rightly, because some of his kind of wild and crazy subordinates gave an interview along with McChrystal to Rolling Stone magazine, of all places. To get to the point, men and women who excel in unusual military operations tend not to be smooth, polished corporate types. And to me, that explains part of why General Milley has gotten himself in trouble. McChrystal, with an ounce of even common sense outside of his military universe, he should have ordered his men strictly, don't talk to Rolling Stone. That's trouble, and I'll do the same. No comment is all you say, and that's an order. During Vietnam, special operations, Green Berets, special forces types would not get above colonel. I think we should all be heartened by the fact that our military is flexible enough and pragmatic enough today that, in fact, you can get top command. As General McChrystal, a very admirable man, as well as outstanding soldier, and General Milley have done. So, end of lecture, I hope. But it's important to get this point across. None of this is mentioned in the media and in our excessively charged political commentary today. Excuse me. I'm sorry I didn't bring water.
No problem. Let's talk about the recent recall election in California involving Governor Gavin Newsom. And you wrote about this, obviously, finding it to be intriguing, not only in and of itself, the recall election, which, of course, did fail. Gavin Newsom is still governor of California, and emphatically so. But you say that I think the headline where I read the column was something to the effect that in the California recall election, the system was the real winner.
Yes.
I mean, even more so than Governor Gavin Newsom in terms of keeping his job. In what way?
Well, it's a flexible way to remove, through established due process mechanisms, a public official who's become extremely unpopular. Thank you for reading the column. It is not the latest one. It bears directly on Wisconsin. California put the system in place because they were, during the Progressive era, directly imitating Wisconsin. We have an enormous and generously funded public university system, University of California, and later on the secondary California State College system, and a very active junior college network. It's all directly mimicking Wisconsin. Senator Robert La Follette, Fighting Bob, who served, I think, as both senator and governor of Wisconsin, a spearhead of the progressive movement, as was his great and more successful Republican rival, Theodore Roosevelt. La Follette ran for president, I think, in 1924 and went nowhere as a third-party candidate, unlike T.R., Teddy Roosevelt, in 1912. To get to the point, the La Follette family went to San Diego every winter because one of their sons suffered from severe lung ailments, which used to be pervasive, like a lot of other unfortunate things, especially for children, before our time. And Fighting Bob couldn't sit still, so he really transformed the Republican Party into a progressive party. So the initiative and referendum, recall, direct citizen participation. Californians who support the system, and my guess is even Governor Newsom does now, can thank him. The governor survived with something like a two-thirds to one-third vote, quite surprisingly, because the Democrats were able to tar his principal contender, a Los Angeles radio talk show host, of being a clone of Trump. Trump, the 800-pound gorilla, the frightening Darth Vader, whatever it is, he's ideal for the Democratic Party currently. You've got to vote for us or you might get some kind of Trump puppet or clone. I think that's the main reason Newsom, who remains as a leader unpopular, survived. Poor handling of the public health problem. At the same time, speaking of elitism, that the governor and his wife, both from very privileged backgrounds, and it shows, they were dining out at elegant restaurants without masks, with rather large groups of guests. This kind of thing, a kind of clumsiness in public relations and arrogance.
Right. Well, and I know that in the most infamous case of that, he also wasn't honest about it. I mean, he made statements saying that this big gathering with a lot of wheeler dealer, high roller,
big time lobbyists. That's right. You're quite right. Thank you.
But I mean, his initial statements about that was that this gathering was out of doors, so it would not have been, in the strictest sense, violating California's protocols. And then it proved to not be true. He was dishonest about that. I mean, someone should, if you really make a grave error in judgment, the least you can do is be honest about it. I mean, that's step one in repairing the damage done, but you know, he wasn't able to do even that. So
it's not the crime, it's the cover-up.
Yeah.
Apropos Watergate.
In this particular case, absolutely.
Also, it is a very powerful economy, and California has giant deficits, except when they don't, and then they have giant surpluses, which they have now. It is one standalone. California is one of the most substantial economies in the world, but they also have persistent problems of homelessness, considerable disruption, a failing school system, one that used to be the jewel of the nation. Again, La Follette's very positive personal legacy. It's a state with money, but lots and lots of social problems.
Yeah.
And all of that, of course, makes the governor a target.
Right.
Most recently, the Californians activists are always launching recalls and referenda of various kinds. Most of them don't go anywhere. But early in this century, they did recall Gray Davis, who was a very effective executive, a Vietnam combat veteran, a very capable lawyer who got elected governor. But these problems back in a couple of decades ago compounded and brought him down, and that's how we got Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger in California. And I think that precedent really, who served two terms, the last time a Republican occupied the governor's mansion, and that history really inspired Republicans to think that with all their problems, this somehow we could have another renaissance as we did briefly earlier in the century.
I'm from
Los Angeles. It's really a fascinating state.
Right.
In personal terms. So sorry if I went on at length.
No, that's fine. But you are in essence a fan of this recall system. I mean, you see it as a valuable tool in a democracy.
I don't think every state should have a populist government, but I think it's great actually that Wisconsin and California have that structure and have that tradition. The progressives were crucial, really crucial, in ending terrible scourges that we don't think about at all today, oppressive and dangerous child labor. Really dangerous factory labor for children and women that has been, it is now totally gone, except for outliers, renegade criminal operators in this country. It used to be a fact of life. And the progressives and Theodore Roosevelt was the most effective at the national level, ended this early in the century. So to me, these initiatives reflect directly that progressive tradition that has been crucial to making us the society and as well as country that we are today. So that's my thinking. But I also think there's room for smoke-filled rooms, and I think part of our problem today is an awful lot of populism in terms of pervasive primaries.
All right.
Yeah. So I think that old-time brokering has a role.
Right. You and I off the air were talking earlier about a past general manager here at WGTD, Frank Falduto. And I remember Frank, who was very heavily involved in politics, one day commenting that he kind of missed those days of the smoke-filled room, where that's where political candidates were chosen. Because, his basic point was, I think they did, generally speaking, a better job. We're not getting better people now without that. That was, in his mind, at least in certain situations, that was a very effective way to kind of hammer out who's going to be the best person for the job. He was speaking, you know, kind of frankly in terms of just kind of his visceral response to that kind of winking out of existence. Not that it's out of existence altogether, but.
You know him far better than I did, but I did have the privilege of meeting him because early in my time at Carthage, I was invited to do this sort of thing on the air. And he sounded like a guy from that earlier era.
Very much so.
He worked as a fight promoter when he was young.
Right.
A pretty brutal way to make a living, even if you're not in the ring. And he told me it was really interesting. It was a great education on the streets, but also he needed the money during the Depression.
But you learn a lot about people.
But also making a living was not something. It's tough anytime, but it was really tough back then. He also was quite fond of Robert Kennedy and was involved in Kennedy's brief and tragically ended when he was assassinated, 68 presidential campaign. The Kennedys are very interesting transitional figures from the smoke-filled rooms to the modern populist era. It was a combination of the two. With tremendous behind-the-scenes, totally non-public activity by their father, Joseph Kennedy, that was crucial to JFK getting the nomination in 1960. The last openly contested conventions were just before then in the 50s, and the two nominees that we got as a result were Dwight Eisenhower and Adlai Stevenson. And I don't know about you, but actually those two gentlemen look pretty good.
They certainly do.
In hindsight.
No argument.
Given the times, I think Eisenhower was the more desirable president, but actually they both would have been fine as president.
Yeah, both fine Americans for
yes,
sure.
Yes, indeed. And again, leaders who in their own ways defined the way we live today.
For sure.
Stevenson in particular in raising the rhetoric level, which Kennedy was able to exploit, ironically, because they were not exactly fond of each other.
Hmm. In another recent column, you talk about an intriguing anniversary, not a particularly happy one, the 10th anniversary of what Standard & Poor's did in terms of downgrading the U.S. government in its debt management. I don't really know enough about this to frame it in the proper terminology, but tell us why. Tell us what happened 10 years ago and why it's worth talking about and reflecting upon 10 years later.
Well, Standard & Poor's, the durable credit ratings agency, lowered the rating of Uncle Sam, who should be wearing a threadbare Uncle Sam suit, from AAA to something just below that. With great fanfare, they announced this, and they got a lot of attention from a sympathetic media, which is always looking for something in the 24/7 nonstop electronic universe that you know so well. And it led to some mild discussion and debate. Not so well publicized was that S&P was under federal prosecution for breaking the law.
Wow.
And they finally paid, I think, about $1.5 billion for, in effect, shilling for financial services companies. And they were giving AAA ratings, A-plus ratings, Gold Star ratings to companies that were prime culprits in the 2007-08 financial collapse and the serious international financial crisis that I remember clearly discussing with you, sir, on
the
air.
It was awful.
Anyway, 2021 is the 10th anniversary, not marked at all. So I did a column, Why Are We Not Paying Attention to This? And I referred to Casablanca, the Hollywood film. A great thing about columns is you can pull in things that don't seem to be related. But S&P was shocked by the behavior of the federal government. Recycled back to the Truman years, and the buck stops here, a line worthy of Casablanca. Harry Truman had that sign. A president I'm very fond of had that sign on his desk in the Oval Office. S&P was not complaining then about the federal government, which had debt levels that are actually greater than today compared to the size of the budget and the size of our economy. It would have been absurd to do so. For one thing, they were seen as shills of Wall Street. And if you look back at S&P reports from that era, they're constantly beating the drum, buy stocks, they're undervalued, which is true in the sense that the Dow Jones, the stock market level, did not reach 1929 levels until 1954. People didn't trust Wall Street. S&P was seen as a shill for Wall Street. But more than that, they would have been pilloried if they had lowered the debt rating of the federal government back then. Mm. We'd just been through World War II and the Great Depression. The Korean War began soon thereafter. The Cold War began almost immediately thereafter. A company that was rightly seen as hardly objective and questionable, as were financial services companies, would have been. So that's the context I tried to communicate in noting the 10th anniversary of the 2011 downgrade.
Right.
In point of fact, our federal government has vast assets, actual and also vast potential assets, that make any comparison with any corporation, even a gigantic global corporation, utterly absurd.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. It is interesting, and I hope that's clear, because it's not a simple subject, as you indicated.
It really isn't. You do say at the end of that column, and let me quote you here, the enormous growth in government spending prompts opportunities for honest risk analysis. So what kind of risk analysis are you talking about there exactly?
The kind that's going on constantly in the marketplace and that is available, if you really look, in the media. I think the Wall Street Journal, not their editorial page, but their news page and news column, certain of their financial columnists provide very good advice. And I think Barron's, which is to me quite boring, but also useful because I'm fortunate enough to have some money that I can invest and should. That kind of analysis is very worthwhile. We are also in a time we've kind of put deficit spending on steroids almost. Mm. We've had something like $5 or $6 trillion in terms of new federal spending, a lot of which hasn't been spent. It's still sitting around, like several trillion dollars, even though Washington is currently fixated on much greater spending initiatives that the Biden administration is pushing. It is not guaranteed that we won't have a repeat of 2007-09, defined somewhat differently. S&P has an opportunity for a real public service. But that's not a company, as far as I'm concerned, that you should take a look at unless they change their ways. I think that's what I was trying to communicate.
Right. Real briefly, let's touch on a couple of other things. I always appreciate when you write about North Korea because you have such experience and expertise when it comes to both North and South Korea. And of course, again, there have been kind of dramatic, unsettling actions and statements, I guess, more than anything from North Korea. And one of the things you remind us that when you're talking about North Korea, you need to expect the unexpected or unpredictability, that is the norm when it comes to North Korea. I wanted to make sure, though, that I had a chance for you to say something that I had not heard about anyplace else, which is namely that North Korea is really struggling right now. In large part because of COVID, and that has had a very, very negative impact on that nation, at least as far as we can tell.
Yes, indeed, and they were struggling long before that.
Of course.
They actually have more natural resources than the South, and when the Korean War ended, both halves of Korea were quite devastated by that terribly destructive war, but in point of fact, North Korea had a stronger infrastructure and potential. And, of course, South Korea is a phenomenal success story of which all Americans should be proud. It's the Koreans' success, but we've been very instrumental, a great success for our foreign policy, starting with Truman, not just economically but politically as well. The army holds things together, an ability to maintain an almost feudal power structure and seal off to a remarkable degree the society from the outside world is the only way I can explain how Kim Jong-un, this eccentric, bizarre leader, has been able to hold on for so long. His grandfather, Kim Il-sung, was a protege of Stalin, had a lot of Stalin's abilities, cold and criminal as they were. And it's not surprising he was able to establish a kind of warlord communist state. The family has deteriorated since then, but they are able to remain in charge.
Hmm. It's amazing. You wrote also recently about the United States and its alliance with Israel, and highlighted a meeting between President Biden and Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett.
Yes.
It sounds like this may be a new chapter after some of the kind of turbulent relations that were there, thanks to Bennett's predecessor, Benjamin Netanyahu, who is now facing, he is on trial, I think.
He is on trial serious felony behavior. He may go to prison.
Right. So what do you make of this new prime minister and of what our relationship is with Israel at the moment?
Well, the new prime minister is a sudden rush of fresh air, as you indicate, and that's all to the great. He's a sort of an amazing guy. And Israel produces a lot of amazing men and women of accomplishment in other areas. He was a high-tech venture capitalist who did very well.
Hmm.
He's a man of farts. He's very knowledgeable about and experienced in military affairs. It's a coalition government. That column was a little while ago, and I'm not an expert on Israel or the Mideast. It's a coalition government and has an Arab party, recognized Arab party, not Hamas or Hezbollah, for the first time participating in the cabinet. Hmm. Not easy for any Israeli leader who gets elected to do. And I think it's very promising that the prime minister, he had to get support from somewhere in their rather chaotic parliamentary system, but it's a very promising sign. And at this point, anybody but Netanyahu almost, that system produced would have been a plus.
Hmm. Finally, I wanted to touch at least briefly, it needs to be very briefly, on I'm looking at columns that have been published since your last visit, and one of them was about the 20th anniversary of 9/11, in which you drew attention to something that probably doesn't get talked about enough, namely that in the wake of that despicable attack, that the United States collectively and our institutions and by and large the American populace showed what you call remarkable maturity and restraint. In the wake of that attack, in contrast to, for instance, the way we looked at Japanese Americans at the onset of World War II. And I was glad that you drew attention to that.
Well,
that's something
you.
We don't talk about enough.
Yes, indeed. The internment of the Japanese was concentrated on the West Coast, but especially the Pacific War was there was a very hateful dimension to that. We're not in a total war now, thank God, but incidents that are publicly known of criminal behavior toward Arabs in our country have been prosecuted. There was an ecumenical service, to be brief, shortly after 9/11. President George W. Bush was there and generally presided. The Imam of North America was there.
Hmm.
I recall paying close attention to that, and I didn't even know, in my ignorance, there was an Imam of North America. That ecumenical spirit dissipated somewhat. I think Bush went on to make some very bad decisions, in my opinion. But I do think it was a very reassuring response collectively after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll stop there.
No, that's right. There is a lot more we could say, a lot more to talk about. But yes, the clock is the tyrant, I'm afraid. But we've managed to cover quite a wide range of issues.
You.
And I appreciate you being here. Dr. Art Sear, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, and a columnist whose work appears all over the country, including the Kenosha News and the Chicago Tribune and many other fine newspapers all across the country. And he is also a regular visitor to WUWM, our neighbor to the north in Milwaukee, and a frequent guest to the morning show. Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you, sir. It's always a tonic and very educational. I really mean that.
Mm-hmm. Tomorrow on the morning show, novelist Juliette Fay and her marvelous novel called Catch Us When We Fall, a beautifully crafted novel that has at the heart of it the issue, the painful issue of alcoholism and the possibility, though difficult to attain, of redemption. On Thursday, Dr. Herschel Krieger from the theater department at Carthage College talks about the theater department's current production, which is Harold Pinter's award-winning play, Betrayal. And on Friday, we commemorate the 150th anniversary to the day of the start of the Great Chicago Fire with an archival interview conducted by Bill Guy with the author of a book